this is Alan Chartok. Today, I'm delighted to have one of my and our favorites, Stephen Gottlieb, joining us. In addition to being a commentator here on WAMC, Stephen Gottlieb is the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. He has served on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union and is in the U.S. Peace Corps in Iran. Steve Gottlieb's latest books are Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Law and Its Application, second edition with Robin L. West, Brian Bix, and Timothy D. Litton. He has written or edited several books on the fields of constitutional law and jurisprudence, and is also widely known for his work on the Supreme Court, constitutional theory, and election campaign law. His articles have appeared in the New York University Law Review, Yale Law and Public Policy, Hastings Law Journal, and Boston University's Law Review, among many others. And he is currently writing books about the U.S. Constitutional Convention and the U.S. Supreme Court under Justice Roberts. Professor Gottlieb has held endowed chairs for distinguished visitors in Akron, Suffolk, Cleveland, Marshall and Marquette Schools of Law, and he's also taught at St. Louis University School of Law and West Virginia University College of Law. Professor Gottlieb is a veteran of the Legal Services Program, the Peace Corps, the corporate practice in New York City. Educated at Princeton and Yale Law School, he served on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union and is a member of the New York Advisory Committee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights, once founded and ran a political action committee himself, and makes time to practice both the piano and the harpsichord. He is married to the former Jeanette Grayson, another former Peace Corps volunteer. They met in Iran, courted in India and in Kashmir, and have two grown children and two granddaughters. Welcome our old friend, Professor Stephen Gottlieb.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, Stephen, it's wonderful to have you here. I don't want to waste a second, but I do want to ask you about our Constitution and some of the legal things that have happened as a result of that. You know, I have always enjoyed courses in civil liberties, in constitutional development, and taken a lot of them in my life. But you have a different view of some of them. Let me start by asking, first of all, what is the value of having this, I believe, oldest surviving written constitution in the world?
Well, one of the basic things that I'm sure you also know as a political scientist is that the longer lived a constitution, the less likely it is going to be at any given moment or year that the democratic system under that constitution will be lost. Political scientists argue about exactly why that is, but it matters that we've had a constitutional tradition for in excess of 226 years. I say in excess because we had a number of constitutions in the original 13 colonies, 13 states, before we had the federal constitution, and there was some conscious borrowing going on in that process. And we had the Articles of Confederation at the same time. I mean, you can, people argue about which is older, the states or the national government, and it's kind of a sterile argument because the Continental Congress actually precedes all of the state constitutions and they encourage it. But we had a national constitution, the Articles of Confederation, that goes back, I think ratification was toward the latter part of the Revolution. I forget if it was 1780 or 1782, and Maryland was the last state to ratify for a bunch of reasons that we don't need to go into right now. So it's a lengthy tradition that really goes back almost to the Declaration of Independence. And that's an important fact in Americans' loyalty to it.
But like everything else, the Constitution was vague on some subjects.
Absolutely. That's part of its glory.
That's part of its glory. It had, as I remember it from my early courses, about 6,000 words in it, which is very brief. You know, we've had amendments to the Constitution which have extended it and the rest of it. But part of the problem, it seems to me at least, is that you get a conservative Supreme Court and they read into the Constitution that everybody has a right to walk around with a gun, or they read into the Constitution that corporations are human beings and have rights. And where they come up with this stuff comes directly from what they think politically. So there are a lot of people who think that the Supreme Court is nothing more than, you know, the supra legislature of this country, as opposed to people who quote read the law. Now, we have something called originalists. What are they, and who are they?
They're people who, in a sense, I'm an originalist, but not in the sense that you mean it. They're people who want to go back, who claim that the only thing that matters is to go back to the way that people understood the constitutional language in the 18th century. But they mean something even more specific than that. Because, and I'd like to get back to this point about whether it's a broad or a narrow, narrowly worded document. They argue, Scalia in the lead of them, that we should be looking not at the principles that were embodied in that text, which would have been understood in the 18th century, but we should look only at the practices, the behavior of people in the 18th century. And so it becomes a very...
Give us an example of that.
How long did it take before somebody was brought before a justice of the peace to be arraigned, for example, or the comparable 18th century provision? I mean, there are all kinds of things like that. Or whether or not anybody had identified a particular logical outgrowth of a constitutional right in the 18th century. There are all kinds of ways that that idea gets used, and it gets used to narrow the meaning of the Constitution. Now, for somebody schooled in the American tradition like me, it feels like the Constitution is wonderful precisely because it's written in very general language. It's written in terms of principles. I think the founders, and I've studied the founders at some length, wanted it to be read and understood in terms of principles. But I have to tell you that, and again, here's where I interlope in political science. I do this all the time. That's been my career. And a number of political scientists is doing studies about constitutional language. And right at this moment, while you were talking, I was trying to get their names in my head because I've met these people and I know them and I would like to credit their work, and their names are escaping me. That's because I'm a few months older than you are. You know, when you get to be my age, Alan, maybe you'll forget a few names too.
Yeah, but forget about it.
What they have found, what they have found is that the more specific a constitutional provision, the more likely it is to be obeyed. And so you even have Putin in Russia noticing that he has a defined term and doing things to deal with that term. He switched offices so that he was still in a position of power. Other leaders have changed the terms. You had the mayor of New York trying to get a change in the length of term of the mayor.
Trying by, basically spending a lot of money.
And also his predecessor trying.
But his predecessor didn't make it, and he objection to his predecessor Giuliani doing it and said, no, the law is the law.
That's right.
But when it was his third term...
Because it was easy for everybody to see that there was a violation there. Whereas when you start talking about due process or freedom of speech or equal protection, and we can talk at great length, and I've studied these things at great length and where they came from and so forth, but on the one hand, it's something that we can read principles into, but on the other hand, it's something that people can read principles out of.
Let me start by asking you some very specific cases. You know, there are revisionists. I think to some degree you're one of them who think that
I hope so.
That some of our recollections about what these cases mean aren't exactly what we think they are. So let me throw out probably the most famous case of all, Marbury versus Madison. Now, first of all, I always love the story because the story is great. I always tell what the case was about in class. And the students always come running up to me and they say, well, did Marbury get his commission or not? And no. I always say, that's not the point. So tell us about the case.
Well, there are multiple ways to describe the case. First of all, the reason that Marbury originally became a famous case is because the first part of Marshall's opinion...
This is Chief Justice Marshall, probably the most influential of all of the chief justices in the history of the country.
That's right. And the leader of the court for 36 years, who clearly had as his objective nation building. And it's one of the two periods of the court's history that we all look back to. I say we all, that constitutional law teachers look back to virtually unanimously as an important and valuable period in the court's history.
And what's the other one, dare I say, Chief Justice Warren?
Well, I'm going to be much broader than that.
Yeah.
Because the other period actually starts under Hughes, and you can see the development of ideas from Hughes in 1930.
That's Charles Evans Hughes.
Charles
yeah.
Evans Hughes, who ran for president as a Republican mm-hmm. against Wilson mm-hmm. in, I think, 1916. He had actually already served as an associate justice and then was reappointed to the court in 1930 by President Hoover to replace Chief Justice Taft, who had also been president of the United States.
Who was most famous for not being able to get out of the bathtub, he was so fat.
Well, I wasn't going to bring that up, Alan. But he's also responsible for our Supreme Court building that we have now.
Sure.
But Hughes really begins the court on a modernizing trajectory and is Chief Justice during some of the early cases that begin to take the Bill of Rights seriously. The First Amendment, the various protections against misuse of the criminal process, and equal protection. There have been equal protection decisions or decisions that were protective of blacks before even Taft. I mean, before Hughes, including the first white primary cases, that is, cases saying you cannot exclude African Americans from voting in primary elections.
And what amendment does the Equal Protection Clause appear in?
14th.
Okay.
It's in the first section of the 14th Amendment, although in a sense it animates the entire five sections. But beginning in 1930 and going well into the Burger Court, so that's a period of something like half a century, about 50 years. And that's a very constructive period in American law where we're, I think, we're into first principles and we're really trying to make this a better democracy and one in which, you know, if you're serving time in jail, it's because you're guilty of something and not because you got railroaded in some way. And the Warren Court really picks up that history that's already several decades old and says, you know, we've tried this, we've tried that, we've tried the other thing. We get this continuing series of cases in which people have clearly been coerced into confessing something that they didn't do. And we're still getting cases like that. I mean, anybody who focuses on the process understands what's going on. And the Warren Court just finally said, you know, this has got to stop. And they tried some ways, some of which have been more controversial than others, to make it stop. But in that sense, the Warren Court doesn't sort of spring fully blown out of the head of Zeus or something like that. Mm-hmm. It builds on a tradition that's already several decades old.
Okay, but we're jumping ahead. So we have now the two major periods, as you say.
Do you want to go back to Marbury?
I do. Tell everybody about what Marbury is about.
So the first part of Marshall's opinion was to excoriate Jefferson, the president, for not giving this commission to Marbury.
Now, let's remember who this was. The Federalists on their way out, as I remember it.
Yes. John Adams.
John Adams.
And Marshall.
And Marshall. Now, what was Marshall, who is now the Supreme Court Chief Justice, what was his job? He was
Secretary of State until he was appointed Chief Justice.
So now the Federalists...
And he had failed to deliver the commission to Marbury.
Yes. The Federals are on the way out. John Adams appoints Marbury.
Who is a staunch Federalist.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these people could be, by modern standards, accused of all sorts of corruption in different ways.
Sure.
And favoritism and so forth. So there's this reason for Jefferson and Madison, his Secretary of State, not to want to give Marbury this commission. But the first part of the opinion is a diatribe against Jefferson. That's what made it famous. It was famous for the party politics of the time.
Wait a second now. So here is the Chief Justice. We talk about the cult of the robe. He has now put the robe on, and he shakes his finger at Jefferson. Why does he do that?
Well, Marshall's a Federalist. Jefferson hasn't followed what Marshall describes as the law.
Right.
Marshall says he was supposed to give this commission. This is an opportunity for a Federalist to accuse a Jefferson was known as a Democratic Republican. That was the party, or Jeffersonian. Jefferson certainly is the primary Jeffersonian, to accuse him of not obeying the rule of law. And you've got to understand one thing about the reports of Supreme Court decisions in this period. There's no public reporting service. These are private lawyers. A guy by the name of Cranch, I forget his full name at that point, who was printing things that he thought would be important, not important, or popular, that would sell, right? So all the Federalists are going to buy this opinion of Chief Justice Marshall because he excoriates their most hated president, Thomas Jefferson. There's another part of the opinion that wasn't very important at the time. That was the part of the opinion when Marshall says, I have a problem here. He doesn't say it on the surface, but the problem is he knows he's not going to get Jefferson and Madison to deliver the commission. And he doesn't want to make the court look weak. So what does he do? He declares the statute that gives him the power to order the president to give this commission unconstitutional. Now, we all teach Marbury as the case expounding on why the court has the power to declare things unconstitutional. But that wasn't controversial at all. There'd been other cases that nobody bothered to report because it was so uncontroversial. In the Constitutional Convention, which I study and am fascinated by, there was very clear debate. Madison was an opponent, by the way, of the power of judicial review, but it was very clear, even more so because there was opposition to it, that when they wrote the words that the, I forgot to bring my Constitution with me, but when they wrote the words that the federal court shall have jurisdiction that were brought in cases arising under the Constitution, and those were the key words, arising under the Constitution, that referred to judicial review. Those were controversial words in the convention, but it was discussed in the convention, including by opponents like Elbridge Gerry, that, in fact, some of the states had already done this. So they knew what they were doing when they inserted that language. And so that part of Marbury was totally uninteresting to that generation. It only became interesting to...
You're talking about judicial review now.
That's yes. Right. It only became interesting to later generations who had lost the memory of what had happened in the 1780s, and the 1790s, before Marshall made this decision in 1803, then this became, you know, the first big exposition of judicial review. And it's the exposition rather than the original statement of it.
So let me get this straight.
Important.
The beauty of this case is, along comes this guy, the Schmigeggy, and he asks the court to make...
I don't know if Marshall spoke Yiddish.
Yeah, right. And asks him...
There was a Jew in the Constitutional Convention, by the way, and that's Robert Morris.
Oh, yeah, Robert Morris,
and he's
of course.
A very significant...
revolutionary figure.
Well, he's very significant in financing the revolution. Yeah. He's very significant in Pennsylvania politics.
Yeah.
He's very significant in establishing the banking system in the United States, including the First National Bank. He's a very significant figure in our history. And he was very close to George Washington, who, by the way, spent the entire convention as a guest in Morris's house. And they invested in things together, as did others. He was an important figure. So it's not just an aside.
This is an aside and an important one. But going back, the guy comes, he asks for relief. He says, make him give me my commission. And Marshall, who hadn't delivered the commission in the first place, which is really a beautiful thing, says and knows. And by the way, later on, we have Jackson and the Indians, the same sort of thing, knows that nobody's going to make anybody do anything, and takes the opportunity to articulate, although we're going to go here in a moment, the concept of judicial review. We have the power to tell you that if you wanted to give us the power to do this, you would have had to do it in the Constitution. And if you want to do this, you have to amend the Constitution. And that's the way it is. So now this is the way that he gets to do this important principle. The question being, did he do it because he knew he was going to lose and not be able to make the president deliver the commission? Or did he do it just because he was looking for an opportunity to do it?
Well,
we'll never know.
You know, I haven't had a seance with John Marshall lately, so I can't really answer. I mean, the received understanding is that this was his way out from putting the court in an embarrassing position where it was going to lose this fight.
Yeah, interesting. Won't be the first time, right? To some degree, when John Roberts sided with Obama on what was has become Obamacare, the health, the Affordable Health Act, there was a sense also that Roberts was trying to save the court also.
That may be true. And I always thought before the decision came down, before you really knew what the justices were going to do, I thought Rehnquist would have that sense of protecting the court in Bush versus Gore, but he obviously did not.
Now, this is Rehnquist is something of a specialty of yours. You wrote a book about Rehnquist.
I did.
And
well, it was about the court, not about him as an individual.
Yeah, but he's the leader.
I did write about him in the book.
Right, he's the leader of the court. Okay, so back to Marbury. You said something before we went on the air that I found fascinating, which is when you talk to people around the world, judicial scholars, they tell you that the single thing that they respect the most about the United States Constitution is the concept of judicial review. And when I said to you, well, you know, Marshall articulated judicial review, you said, hey, this was around a long time before Marbury versus Madison.
Right. And it's in the Constitution. If you read the word, so understanding the 18th century language, it's in the rising underpower. But you got to understand, most constitutions are deals. It's not just a group of people getting together in Philadelphia and saying, you remember those great principles that we had in the Declaration of Independence? Well, what does that mean for a constitution? I mean, John Adams was writing, wrote a book that he was trying to expound what a Republican constitution meant. And there are certain areas of the Constitution drafting where they're just being ideological in that way. They're all small r in modern terms. There's no direct relationship between the Republican philosophy of the 18th century and the capital R Republican Party of the modern era, probably was somewhat when it was founded in Lincoln's day. But my point was that there was a deal. There were many deals in the Constitution. There were deals over slavery. There were deals over the extent of the commercial power and whether there'd be any limits on it, et cetera. So the interests of different regions of the country were in opposition, and they had to make a number of deals. That's typical of Constitution drafting processes. Now, some constitutions are described as pacts because some constitutions evidence that more than others. But when people are aware that they are making a deal and they're concerned about the survival of an aspect of that deal, one of the techniques is to put in a court and to give the court the power of judicial review. One of the most amazing examples of that is in South Africa. When Mandela and the others were involved in negotiating a bargain in the early 90s that results in the temporary constitution of 1993, they wrote a set of constitutional principles. And the deal was that the final constitution, which would be written by the legislature that would be elected under the temporary rules, had to be approved by the constitutional court they were setting up. So there's actually a decision, it's huge, of the South African Constitutional Court deciding on the provisions of the draft final Constitution of 1996 in South Africa. And they in fact held several provisions unconstitutional, primarily dealing with their forms of federalism.
Federalism being defined as the relationship between the central government and the parts of the government, in our case,
right,
the states.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly. The Indian Constitution is an enormous document, created by largely by men who'd been educated at places like Oxford and Cambridge, clearly showing a great deal of Western liberal constitutionalism, liberal not in, again, in the sort of a contemporary political sense, but in a broader philosophical sense. And the Supreme Court of India has also found one of the amendments that Indira Gandhi tried to impose on the Indian Constitution, I think this is in the 1970s, was unconstitutional. Actually, they did it twice, two different amendments. You know, their struggle between their constitutional court and their government is a little bit like some of our struggles here, because what sets up this battle between Gandhi and the court is Gandhi trying to do some redistributive measures and the court fighting it on constitutional grounds. So Gandhi keeps having the legislature pass amendments to the Constitution. And finally, she goes a step too far. She has them pass amendments that protect her ability to stay in office. And the court says, you can't do that. But then the other interesting thing about it is the court changes. That as Indian politics and the Indian legislature become much more conservative about India's social problems, the court jumps out in front and starts trying to do things for all the impoverished peoples that write letters to it and bring cases to it in a variety of ways that are very different for what the Indian court has permitted. But so the Indian court, where it was once to the right of the government, is now considerably to the left of the Indian government.
And we see some of this in Pakistan, too, don't we?
We do. There, the court has had to fight for its very life.
Sure.
Because the head of the Pakistani government tried to depose the court and members of the court. And there were demonstrations in this country about that. I was out on the street with other lawyers and people from the various groups that were concerned about that right here in Albany, demonstrating against what he did. But he nearly took the court apart.
But Stephen Gottlieb, you told me, preceding this taping, that the one thing that, and you started on this, and I think you've made the case, that is incredibly respected in these other countries is the power of judicial review.
Although they all handle it and use it differently. In France, it was de Gaulle who wanted a court and created a court specifically to protect his powers under, what was it, the Fifth Republic in France, which was redesigned to put a lot of power in executive hands. And he created a court that would protect those powers specifically. Now, of course, in Europe, with the international treaties that create the European Union and the European Community, and there are all sorts of overlapping jurisdictions over there, but they have courts, and they enforce these international agreements against local states.
I want to come back to American government. As always, I love talking to Steve Gottlieb. He knows so much, Stephen Gottlieb. Talk to me about the case.
Tell that to my students, will you?
Absolutely, I certainly will. Talk to me about McCulloch versus Maryland. Now, that's an interesting case.
That's a case which involves the battle over federal versus state powers. Maryland tried to tax the branch of the U.S. bank that was situated in Maryland. And the case came to the Supreme Court, I think it's 1890. And Marshall says the part cannot tax the whole. So that's a blow that Marshall struck for nationalism. There were many in that period. Of course, the originalists, many of them like to go back and try to deconstruct Marshall and take him apart. And no, he really didn't do all the things that he did, etc. But Marshall was a nationalist. And that's very clear. And it was much more important to, I mean, he was from Virginia. He was appointed by a Federalist, John Adams, who was from Massachusetts, but he was a Virginian. I believe he had slaves. I haven't specifically looked that up. I'm sure I've seen it, but I don't remember. But I'm sure he did. But he freed slaves as a Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. There are decisions in which Marshall decides that certain people have a right to go free. Now, it's not that he declared slavery unconstitutional or anything of that sort, but it's sort of like where there's a gap in positive law, where he thought he could rule in the in those gaps, he took advantage of that.
So he's a nation builder. If we take a look at the Marshall reign, we will see substantial nation building going on. In the McCulloch versus Maryland, I'm probably wrong, but do I remember the power to tax is the power to destroy?
I believe that phrase comes from that case.
Sure.
Although another justice said later, not while this court sits.
Let's jump way into the future and come up to the case that so many of our school children are taught every year is so important in terms of turning a corner, and that's Brown versus Board of Ed.
Boy, the problem with Brown is where do you start? So let me tell you where I started.
Okay.
Because there's so many ways to address this. But I actually started in the early days of the Massachusetts colony because I started with education. And fairly early on, there is a controversial form of integration going on. It's not about blacks and whites. It's about boys and girls. And part of this is happening because some of the teachers are the women, and they're bringing their daughters with them. So actually, later on, after Horace Mann becomes a major figure in educational circles and expands this idea of using education for integration, he's talking about rich and poor. He's talking about Bill Bradley. I mean, he didn't know Bill Bradley, obviously, but a modern example. Bill Bradley's the son of a banker. And he went to public schools in, what was it, Crystal City, Missouri? So in those public schools, there were ne'er-do-wells, meaning people who would never, you know, amount to anything. But there were children of working people. There were children of people who didn't have a job, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know specifically who was there. But in that kind of a small town, I used to live in Missouri for a few years, there would be people of all kinds. And Bradley went to school with them. Less so. We actually overlapped at Princeton, but I never met him. I rooted for him. I never met him. Princeton was not that kind of a world. But for Horace Mann, the point of public schooling was, in most of the U.S. as it existed at that time, if you have a single public school that everybody in town comes to, you're educating lots of people who would not otherwise think of themselves as your peers. You're educating them to get together. They're getting to know each other. They're playing together. You know, later on, they're on the basketball court together and so forth. And right on the heels of what Horace Mann does, there's the gender thing. And if you read debates about gender in the 1830s and 40s, you could literally change the words to black and white, and you would see the same kinds of arguments. There's going to be flight. Parents of daughters are going to flee from this school because otherwise their daughters will be going to school with the rougher sort, and we wouldn't like this. But on the other side of it, there are people talking about the importance of boys and girls learning from each other. So now we have rich and poor. Deliberately, we want them to meet and mix and understand each other and understand that a Republican society, you all need to care about each other. I mean, that's very much a part of Republican philosophy of the 18th and 19th centuries. And now you have guys and girls have to meet and learn about each other. Okay, so now take this whole thing about learning and mixing into the military. The military has a huge problem. Actually, throughout American history, I mean, the people who believe that everybody spoke English in the 18th century are just plain nuts. There were huge German-speaking communities in the United States, very big and important in Pennsylvania. And there were still German-speaking populations. People who had formed their towns a long time before and did not make the switch to English until after World War II. I encountered that in Texas when I was in Peace Corps training. They sent me to one of these towns, and I interviewed people about it. But the military had a big problem, and the problem got worse in the middle of the 19th century as people started to pour in from the revolutions in 1848 and the famine in Ireland, and then later on you get a lot of people coming in from Eastern Europe, And in the old days, we all used to have our separate regiments, right? The regiments were sort of recruited that way. So you have the 1st Massachusetts, the 5th New York, whatever. And you have people that have names that are derived from the home country. And all these groups had their own language. And then the army is trying to figure out, how do we manipulate an army with people of all these different kinds and all of these different languages? And the army tried a bunch of things to deal with it. By the time of the Second World War, the answer was total integration in the army, with the exception of race. And even then, they started doing it at the end of World War II. They just threw people in from all over the United States, regardless of their original language, and they had to learn to work together no matter where they came from or what they spoke. And some of this, I mean, the political implications of this were very much understood. And when you start talking about integrating the army racially, I mean, there's some understanding of that problem. Even in World War I, there's discussion about it. And Teddy Roosevelt talks about sleeping in the same tent being a real democratic influence. I don't have his words on the tip of my tongue right now, but being a democratic influence. This is well understood what's going to happen. And the army moves to integration of everything except race. It couldn't quite go there in World War I. But even in World War II, it's using black soldiers to resupply white units by the end of World War II. And there's study about this. Samuel Stouffer, who did some of the famous study that I'm sure you're well familiar with, Alan, of our attitudes toward the First Amendment rights of people that we don't agree with, was his book called Communism, Conformity, and Civil Liberties in 1955 or 6, something like that. But in World War II, the Army sent him to study integration and the effects that it had on attitudes. And the answer is the effect that it has is very positive. And that if you talk to white soldiers who had been, well, exposed to any group, but one of the things specifically he did, if they were serving with black soldiers in the same unit, their attitude toward the future ability of the country to integrate was much more positive than if they did not have that experience. So the military was looking at this in World War II very self-consciously, and then all sorts of other prejudices were very much examined and were much more amenable to going away.
Into all of this comes both Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry Truman.
Absolutely.
Harry Truman from Missouri, who really did the deed.
Who ordered the military to integrate. And also, by the way, appointed Eleanor Roosevelt, U.S. representative, to design the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was partly understood to take some of American ideals and contribute them on the world scene. But of course, it creates language that applies regardless of one's race, religion, gender, whatever. And Eleanor Roosevelt played a large part in those developments, which is not to say that the rest of the world was some unwilling partner in this. They were very much pushing toward an even better document.
So let's get back to Brown for a moment now. I think, Professor Gottlieb, the one thing you've taught us here is these decisions don't come springing out of some Chief Justice's mind without any background.
Not only that, Chief Justice Vinson was appointed by Truman. And when Brown first came to the U.S. Supreme Court, Vinson was the Chief Justice. And Vinson didn't want to go there.
He was a nasty piece of work.
But wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Vinson's the Chief Justice when they decide Shelley versus Kramer, which says there'll be no racially restrictive covenants. Courts cannot enforce a racially restrictive covenant in the United States. That's 1948. Vinson's the Chief Justice while they decide a series of cases saying you cannot exclude African Americans. They probably used the word Negro in those days, but you cannot exclude African Americans from graduate programs. Now, those cases don't start with Vinson. There's a very meaningful, in fact, in some ways, the most radical of all of those cases is in the late 1930s, because Missouri wanted to send African-Americans who wanted to study law to any of the neighboring states. Well, that includes Illinois, and there's some very fine law schools in Illinois. I don't know that there was a law school in Missouri that compared, let's say, with the University of Chicago or maybe the University of Illinois at the time, which is not to say that there aren't some very fine law schools there now. But the court said, I don't care how good the law school is in Chicago or in Champaign-Urbana. That's not the point. The point is that there are specific advantages from hobnobbing with other Missouri people in the law school. So that's a very radical decision. It's in the 1930s. Vinson comes along later, and his court decides a whole bunch of those cases in the late 40s and the early 50s. So if you've been reading the U.S. reports, which is the official reporter for the U.S. Supreme Court, and then you're looking at Brown, the question isn't doctrine. The question is guts.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question, because you took such umbrage at my characterization of Vinson, which I stand behind. But
okay.
But would Vinson have had the guts to do what Warren did?
Clearly not.
Yeah.
Clearly, he wasn't ready to draw that conclusion, and Justice Reed was not happy about it. Past those two men, there were others who were scared and were only willing to go there if it was unanimous. I think it's pretty clear that Justice Robert Jackson, who's actually a graduate of where I teach, Albany Law School.
And was well known because of his participation in the Nuremberg trials.
Number one in the class, too young in the view of the Board of Trustees at the time, so they didn't let him be the valedictorian. We invited him back years later, and he spoke before my time at Albany Law School. There's a wonderful man down at St. John's University in New York City, John Barrett, who's been doing wonderful work on Robert Jackson. But anyway, Robert Jackson was virtually on his deathbed when Brown was decided, and he got himself to the court to be there when they decided the case. I think he was very strongly for it.
Maybe his experiences at Nuremberg helped him in that.
That could be. Well, let me give you an anecdote about that. When Barrett was here talking about Jackson, I asked him about a couple of photographs that showed some black individuals with justices of the court. And I don't remember the names, but John pointed to one of them and said that was Jackson's aide. But before he was aide to Jackson, he was aide to Justice McReynolds. Now, McReynolds was an anti-Semite. He was a racist. He was a horrible man, and he was understood to be a horrible man by everybody else on the court. When this individual was then reassigned to Jackson, he thought he had died and gone to heaven. And John told me that when McReynolds died, the court sent a clerk to be its official representative at the funeral. But when this aide to Jackson, black individual that had worked at the court for a number of years, when he died, every one of the justices attended his funeral. And there are other connections. I mean, Frankfurter had taught one of the leaders of the legal teams that were working on the problems of blacks and working in the NAACP. And this was at Harvard. But he then became a conduit suggesting people to hire for movement jobs of some sort. Now, Thurgood Marshall was not one of his people, because Marshall comes in a different route. But Frankfurter has ties to this community. But Frankfurter is also one of the people who realizes that the big problem is the court has to be unanimous. And so he plays a role in delaying the decision. And that's a very fateful delay, because over that summer, Vinson died and Warren comes in. And Warren had done some racist things in California as governor of California, particularly toward the Japanese Americans. But Warren doesn't hesitate on this issue. And he goes about bringing everybody along. And the last the last holdout, because as I say, they really want unanimity. And the last holdout is Reed, who's from Kentucky. And Reed said, okay, but don't make them do it all of a sudden. So there's a deal there. And the court, except for the time when Eisenhower had to send the troops into Little Rock and the governor tries to prevent the enforcement of federal law, except for saying, this is federal law and you got to do it, which the court does in that crisis. The court basically did not dip its toe back into the issue of how the schools would desegregate for another 16 years. It did decide a whole bunch of cases per curiam, which means without an opinion, without dissents. The court was unanimous, saying you can't have segregated swimming pools, you can't have segregated, you know, whatever the facility, if it has anything to do with the government, you can't segregate it. So there are a whole bunch of decisions which say you can't do this, that, and the other thing on the basis of Brown. But it doesn't come back to the school issue. I think my numbers were wrong with 16 years. I think it's because it's 1954, and we're talking about 1968, so it's 14 years. Before the Warren court, this is just before he resigns, comes back to that issue. So it's actually the Berger court that had the bulk of the work to do to figure out how to enforce Brown versus Board.
Just for our edification, some of these cases are set up. In other words, when I say set up, Rosa Parks doesn't want to give up her seat. There's been a lot of controversy. I've heard testimony on both sides in which she says, yeah, no, that was just me. I just didn't. There were other people who say, we put Rosa on the bus. You know, we wanted to make this case.
And that wasn't the first time that she did this on the bus.
Uh-huh. Also Brown, to some degree, they looked around for the right case to bring along.
Well, the question is who looked around for which right case?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Actually, the national staff led by Marshall wasn't satisfied that these were the right cases.
Thurgood
at the
Marshall
time.
In this case, yes.
Thurgood Marshall, yes. We've had, as far as I know, two men whose last name was Marshall on the court, and they're both wonderful.
And one who one was probably given less credit than necessary for winning the Second World War.
Oh, General Marshall. Well, I was talking about people on the court.
I know.
Yeah. Okay. But local attorneys were fighting these cases, and Marshall came around to say, we have to do it. So, and there were others who still thought it was too soon, but he eventually became the champion and said, these are the cases and we go with them.
I guess the one thing that we're learning, we only have a couple of minutes now from you, Professor Gottlieb, is that these cases always have precedent, and I don't mean legal precedent, but both sociological and legal precedent that lead to a specific decision. So our tendency to say, wow, it started and ended here, it's just wrong.
Can I make what I think is one of the most important points to make about all of this? And it's a beautiful lead in, it started and ended. Nothing ended with Brown. And one of the things that we have discovered, which I think is tragic, is that in the Federal Housing Administration, which guaranteed mortgages, and therefore, which is largely responsible for the suburbanization of America. This is mostly what's going on after World War II and continues. And I don't know when this ceased, but there's a period post-World War II, a lengthy period, when they are saying to the banks, we will not guarantee a mortgage to a black in the suburbs. In fact, we won't guarantee a mortgage to a black. So it has two consequences. One, it prevents blacks from moving into the suburbs, and therefore it segregates the North in a way the North had never been segregated. And two, that also has something to do with the disinvestment in the black areas of the cities. So that problem gets doubly worse. The jobs move out to the suburbs, and this area has been abandoned by official order, and the court has never been willing to deal with this is you know, the Berger and Rehnquist court, never been willing to deal with the implications of that behavior on the pathologies that we still try to deal with in the North. Saying anything ended with Brown is just totally false.
Well, this is the first of many programs we'll be doing on the courts and our Constitution with Stephen Gottlieb, I hope, because we have a lot more that we need to do in talking about Sandra Day O'Connor, Rehnquist, gay marriage, Citizens United, Gideon versus Wainwright. So, Professor, we hope we'll see you again soon enough. Our guest has been Stephen Gottlieb, distinguished professor of law at Albany Law School. His latest books are Jurisprudence, Case and Materials, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Law and Its Applications, second edition, with Robin L. West, Brian Bixen, Timothy D. Litton, and Morality Imposed, The Rehnquist Court and Liberty. Thank you, Stephen Gottlieb. I'm Alan Chartok.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.